Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right, every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Who are the sane centrist Democratic voices you look to who could be a credible Treasury Secretary under the next president?
Boy, frankly, Scott Bessent's pretty good. I've been pleasantly...
Tell me more about that. I did not expect to hear that from you.
Yeah, well, okay. He has to say tariffs are a good idea.
Does he have to?
Well, he'd be gone.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Ablon. One of the key issues of our time is the U.S. dollar against the backdrop of escalating debt and increasingly chaotic governance here at home. All that raises the specter of the U.S. dollar no longer being the world reserve currency, and that could have catastrophic effects for your wallet, for your investments, for your family and your children's economy and the America they inherit. Joining us to talk about that is Harvard professor Kenneth Rogoff. He is a former chief IMF economist. He is a chess grandmaster and the author of the new book, Our Dollar, Your Problem, came out in 2025, but incredibly prescient and someone I look to for economic wisdom. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let's just start off here. Explain it to an intelligent 12-year-old. Why does the dollar and its precarious position as the world reserve currency matter to them?
The fact that the dollar is the lingua franca of the global financial system is worth a lot to the United States. So at a very crude level, which I'm afraid a 12-year-old might not appreciate, is that your mortgage is cheaper, your car loan is cheaper, and certainly how much the government borrows is cheaper. You save money because people like your currency and you don't have to pay as much to borrow. About 1% on all of those things compared to what it would be otherwise. But there are other things that maybe the 12-year-old understands better, which is the fact that everything's going through the dollar, so much of global trade, gives us this incredible trove of information about everything going on in the world. Every distant transaction, which is an international transaction, and there's it doesn't have to involve the United States. It could be between Argentina and Poland. Often goes through the dollar. That means we see it. And that gives us this incredible information about the world, which a lot of other countries don't like. I mean, obviously our enemies or our competitors, should we call them, China, doesn't like it. But a lot of our friends don't much like it either. And moreover, because of it's so important to be able to use our banking system, it's kind of like our dollar system for making trades and clearing everything. If we tell a country or some entity, sorry, you can't use the dollar anymore until you're nice to us, it's quite a punishment. We call that an economic sanction. And we're doing that a lot on Russia since they invaded Ukraine. But actually, we've been doing this for a couple decades before that. So it's a lot of money. It's a lot of power. And if you don't have to fall completely from grace to lose a lot, if the dollar gets a smaller share of all this information, it's obviously worth less. There are more ways to get around it. And clearly, the interest rate will go up if less people are having to use the dollar. You have to pay more, so it's a very big advantage. And to a country which already, let's just say, is debt challenged, like we're already a little bit worried about paying our bills, to have our interest rate just go up on us could be painful.
hugely painful. And I think part of it is that we have taken this incredible global advantage for granted, really almost for living memory at this point. And we're going to get to the impact of the debt and the escalation and the Trump administration's meddling with the independence of the Fed and the impact of Iran on global stability and the economy. But I just want to press home this point to make it real for people. Do a little day after scenario. If the worst were to occur, which in the context of the dollar is no longer being the world reserve currency, our debt got out of control, our governance became less and less predictable, the independence of the Fed seemed permanently compromised, what would that look like? What would the impact be for the average American in the next days and weeks?
I'll go with this, but just to be clear, this is a slow burn, takes decades. It's not likely to be a morning after unless we really go nuts and do stuff so that no one wants our currency. But, you know, I can only say the UK, the United Kingdom, used to be the dominant currency. It had the franchise for more than 100 years and maybe for a few decades shared it with the United States. After World War II, the UK no longer had it, but I'm not sure they knew it. And they kept getting into trouble again and again and again. They would have to get bailed out by the International Monetary Fund. That's an international lender that lends to troubled countries. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, the UK kept having to go hat in hand. And, you know, partly it still thought everyone wanted its money, but they didn't. Now, again, that's hyperbolic. The UK went through two wars, World War I and World War II. It won both wars, but at great, great cost. Yes, and yeah, that's a big part of how it fell. And often that happens, but you don't have to lose a war to lose some of the shine on your dominance. And I think that's been happening actually for a decade. And I can't tell you which direction things have changed under Trump, but I suspect the acceleration of the dollar's lingua franca franchise probably is going to increase, not decrease.
Well, you say that the dollar probably hit its peak in 2015, the second to last year of the Obama administration. And certainly the things Trump has been doing, which is, you know, exploding our deficit and our debt, attacking the independence of the Fed. All of this, I assume, is directly out of the anti-prescription playbook, what you should not do as president, correct?
Yeah, but to be fair, I think both parties were headed in this direction. So Trump
Let's just talk about the executive action the president's taken. Clearly, deficit debts have gone up for a long time. I think Republicans
have
a burden because they talk a good game but don't execute on it.
No, absolutely. But I was going to talk about the independence of the Federal Reserve. Like, we used to have gold standing behind the dollar. Now it's the Federal Reserve's promise that we're not going to make your money worthless. We're not going to print a lot. We're not going to make you regret that you're managing India's central bank reserves and you put so much in dollars. And the Federal Reserve's commitment to keep inflation low or do its best is very important. And I just want to emphasize, John, neither party likes it. The progressives do not like central bank independence any more than Trump does. They have different reasons for it. But I mean, I'm not even sure they like banks, but I talk about that a lot in my book, that both sides are pushing at that. It's almost like we used to have a lot of inflation in the 70s. A lot of listeners won't even remember, but it got tamed. It was painful. We tamed it. And then people just sort of forget it could come back. They forget why it was tamed. And yeah, so central bank independence is a problem. But also deficits, it's very hard to get elected or to stay in office in the U.S. and not pump prime the debt. Americans like spending. They don't like taxes. They've gotten spoiled by a long period where the world interest rates were just very low, meaning you could borrow and there wasn't really an urgent bill to pay. But that's changed. interest rates have gone way up, I would say normalized. And now our debt's really high, the interest rate's really high, our payments are really high. And then certainly Trump's big, beautiful bill was adding a lot to it. I think the Congressional Budget Office just announced a day or two ago, we had added $1 trillion to our debt in the first 5 months of the year. And I guess, you know, there's that old saying that used to be about millions. I can't remember which senator said it.
It was the senator from Illinois, Dickerson, said that with a billion here, a million there, you're talking real money.
Now it's $1 trillion here and $1 trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. I mean, these numbers are just, you know, breathtaking. And, you know, interest rates have not shot up, but they've gone up in recent years. And despite the fact we're facing a pretty difficult time right now, normally when you go in a war like this, interest rates come down. The U.S. is a flight to safety. Everyone wants to put their money in the dollar. Not so much this time.
Interest rates haven't shot up. That people aren't seeing the dollar as a safe harbor, given in the wake of the attack on Iran.
They see us as the source of the crisis. So normally a pandemic, you know, something that's occurring from the outside, you feel safe with the U.S. government. They're looking at the U.S. government. They're looking at our reluctance to make the Federal Reserve independent and keep inflation low. They're looking at our reluctance to try to maintain a sober budget deficit path. And yeah, they love us. They love our debt. But how much do they love our debt? And I would say right now, they love it as long as the interest rate's pretty good, which means they don't love it like they used to. And despite the fact there's a crisis and they're nervous, they're not fleeing to the dollar the way they used to.
Well, and I think that speaks to a diminished credibility or reputation for chaotic governance, which, of course, a lot of our, the ratings agencies have cited for several years now, but particularly under Donald Trump. When you heard that we were attacking Iran, you wrote the book, This Time It's Different. The sort of glib sense that this will all be easily contained, brought that title back to mind. What were your thoughts?
Well, I was surprised and uncertain, but a reporter from the New York Times, Peter Goodman, asked me this question not long ago. And he said, well, the markets seem to think it's fine, that nothing's going to happen. And I made an analogy to when the Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, that people may not remember, but that set off World War One. Nobody knew that it was setting off World War One. They thought, oh, this will be over in a week or a month. And when you launch into something like this, you don't know. So, I mean, I've emphasized that we don't know how this will play out. Even if it ends in a few days, it doesn't really mean it's over. You're starting something that potentially has huge ramifications, and there are economic ramifications. This is not a localized war. This is part of a larger geopolitical battle between the U.S., China, Russia. It's not just a surgical strike on Iran. It's much, much bigger. And so maybe it's brilliant. I don't know how it's going to end, John. I mean, as a former chess player, you mentioned, we sometimes describe a position as saying all results are possible. You could win, you could lose, it could be a draw. No idea where what this position could lead to. And that's how I feel about where we are on this day that we're speaking, where, it can go in directions that make it look like a good move economically over the long run. But there are certainly a lot of directions that it could go the other way.
Look, I mean, the only thing we can say for certain looking at history is that wars always have unintended consequences. That's a safe bet. So if you're too glib about the fact that, you know, you can declare victory and things will revert to the mean, that's where you're inevitably wrong.
Well put. I couldn't improve on that. I mean, so we just don't know what's going on here. But I mean, specifically, the oil price has gone up and we thought we never had to worry about that again.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you know, the oil's jumping up and down all over the place. You've got, you know, potential stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz. You've obviously got oil, you know, has been, a lot of the refineries have been bombed or isolated. What this combined with Venezuela putting on your economic implication hack, you know, where do you see this going for the American consumer?
The truth of the matter is Americans are better insulated from this than most countries because we are oil exporters. And when the price goes up, consumers lose, but oil companies gain. I know people say, well, that's terrible. That doesn't do me any good. But in principle, we could tax it back and it's not such a disaster like it is for Europe, like it is for Japan, like it is for many countries, even China. And also, we're not starved for oil. Some countries, really, it's not just the price is high, they're struggling to get it. But I think the way the American consumer will feel it from certainly the higher prices, I mentioned that, gas prices, oil goes into everything. When you eat corn, it has oil input, energy input into it of some type anyway. And when energy prices go up, it puts prices up on everything. It's not as bad as it would have been 50 years ago or even 25 years ago, because despite our, let's say, reluctance to make progress, we have made a lot of progress. We're less dependent, but we're still need it. Maybe we use, 60% as much as we used to for what we're producing, but it's still a lot. And the price has the potential to double, triple, and be very painful, even if that's the only thing going on. So it's funny because I used to talk about oil all the time when I was chief economist at the International Monetary Fund in the early 2000s. Everybody worried, what if the price of oil goes up? What are we going to do? Everyone thought that was a real sensitive point for the global economy. And then, in recent years, it's never going to be a problem. Shale oil in the United States, if they try to do something, we'll produce a little more. Saudi Arabia will help us. Well, guess what? This is a big hit. This is 20% of global energy, oil supply. And the price effects, are massive. We don't know how it's going to play out. So I wouldn't say overnight it'll cause a recession, but if this keeps up, of course it will.
You mentioned, of course, the fact we're a great exporter. China and Russia have been drawing on Iran for reserves. They've got a rapacious capacity, despite being producers in the case of Russia themselves. How does this disrupt Russia and China? And what do you think the knock-on effects will be, putting on your chess grandmaster hat?
Well, it's a really good question. I think Russia basically is benefiting from this so far. So oils, I think it's something like half their government revenues are still coming from energy exports, which are mostly oil. This makes the price go way up. We don't know how much, but 50%, 100%. And the United States is already openly saying, we'll kind of look the other way. If India or China wants to buy Russian oil, we used to, want to punish them for that. But because supplies are so choked off, we're backing off. So that means not only has the world price gone up, but it used to be that India and China could get a very nice price from Russia because they couldn't sell it anywhere else. And so Russia is benefiting from that. Russia is certainly benefiting from the fact we're using all our missiles in Iran, and we don't have an infinite stockpile of them. We don't produce them cheaply. Russia's benefiting from we're paying so much attention to that. There's no question. China's another matter. China is very vulnerable as an energy importer. They can get more from Russia, but they get a lot from the Middle East. They get a fair amount from Iran. It's interesting that China has sort of held back so far. They don't want to, of course, don't want to get involved. But if this continues, they're going to have an interest in stepping in and being involved in the negotiations, because their economy couldn't stand a big sustained cutoff in oil or reduction in supply. They're still a manufacturing economy. Yeah, they have a lot of green energy. They got nuclear. They got coal, fossil fuel, but it's coal. But China's a big loser. China also loses, of course, because they were heavily invested politically in Iran. They have this thing called the Belt and Road Project, where they gave a lot of money. They have, and suddenly their client state is being attacked. They're not able to do much about it. Again, early days, I mean, to see who's the winner and loser. Maybe if it ends very decisively in the U.S.'s favor, or the Trump's vision of what's a decisive victory, Russia gets cut off from its drone supplier, the prices drop down. But at the moment, Russia's a winner, China's a loser.
You talk about China a lot in the book, because obviously as a rising power, some people might say, well, that's inevitably the power who, will displace the dollar over time. But that hasn't been a real threat because of their opaqueness, because of their chaos. What are the strategic weaknesses you see in China as a reason why they're not likely to dislodge the United States economically?
Well, I first say I do think they'll displace part of the dollar's market. Asia's half the U.S. dollar market. China is an important player, not in its own, both in its own right and for having other countries hold dollars. As China's moving away from the dollar, a lot of Asia will use it less. But of course, the challenge to China is central planning, you know, has its advantages, but it has its limits. So something I write about a lot in the book, and I'd worked about on for many years, is China was really good at building infrastructure. They were really, you know, roads, pipes, bridges, high-speed trains. They're really good at building real estate, houses, buildings. But that's not everything to an economy. You have this real estate and you have these roads. You have to have businesses. You have to have entrepreneurship. And there are large parts of China which are have beautiful buildings and beautiful roads, but almost the smell of death because the ideas, the people haven't come there. So we economists call this, and sorry for this, but decreasing returns. You invest and it's good. You invest more, it's good, but it's not as good. Well, you know, you build too many houses that you don't need, it starts to be a waste. And so China was so invested in this approach. It was, in some measures, a third of their economy, infrastructure and real estate. And it's just not easy to move. And one can say, well, there'll be green energy, solar panels, electric cars. But first of all, these things are small still compared to the real estate market. They're tiny by comparison. And second, you know, the demand isn't the same. They're already struggling to place their cars and they're already running big export surpluses. So I think China will struggle to be like, as do as well as the United States. That said, it is clearly the big competitor in the world. It's not Europe, sure. It's China. They have the ambition. They have, you know, incredible people. And they don't have to do as well as us to be quite a competitor.
Oh, that goes without saying. I think I'm speaking to the fact that sometimes we as Americans have a very human tendency to overestimate our opponent's strength, and they've got some structural weaknesses as well. But I want to return the focus back to the United States, and I want to start getting to solutions, which is obviously hard to do. You're talking about something like the U.S. dollar. But what would a sane policy for the U.S. dollar look like from a new administration? Because the Trump administration has been trying to do something that seems contradictory, right? A weak dollar for increasing manufacturing exports, but a strong dollar to use overseas. Doesn't make any sense to me, but you're smarter than I am. Explain if it does make sense, but more importantly, what the next president and Treasury Secretary should do to stabilize things.
Well, I mean, the basic steps are pretty straightforward. So one is, we used to give other countries gold for the dollar. People forget that. But after World War II, up until 1971, if you were a country, not people, but if you were a country, India, England, Japan, anybody, and you had treasury bills, dollars, you could take them and you could get gold. The dollar was as good as gold. Then we went off of that and suddenly we could print money because we didn't have to back it with gold. And we got a lot of inflation. It took us a long time to figure that out. And we came up with this device of having an independent central bank. I actually think I wrote the first paper about that. And so it's worked. It's not perfect. Central banks make mistakes. People are always criticizing the Fed. But on the whole, we've been able to tame inflation. And if we forget that, and I would insist that both parties have had trouble remembering that, that's going to be a problem. So we need to preserve the independence of the central bank until we come up with something better. But the other is, you know, people got used to this idea that debt is a free lunch. And it's not just politicians. I would say an embarrassing number of economists came to that conclusion also. They saw interest rates being very, very low. And they said, well, why shouldn't we borrow a lot? We hardly have to pay anything for it. Why are you worried about it? And I would debate them and say, well, it's low now because we just had a financial crisis and not a pandemic. But normally they're high and it's going to come back. And they have. And we need to take some steps to try to deal with it. I certainly talk to both sides of the aisle. And it's difficult for them because the voter has gotten used to just never having to make a compromise. Everywhere else in the world, except maybe France, which is really running into trouble, everywhere else in the world's kind of figured this out. That's why I don't want to seem, you know, hyperbolic, but I don't see a way out of this until we have some kind of debt crisis that convinces the voter that something needs to be done. Because if I advise some politician, well, you just balance the budget more than you're doing, they'll get kicked out. Somebody will come in, why are they doing that? And so that's the problem.
Let's break those things out. Let's break out. Let's address the debt first and then the Fed. Because, you know, Dick Cheney infamously said that, you know, deficits don't matter. And by the way, there was a parenthetical after that politically. You know, the Republicans have run on deficit and debt fears whenever a Democrat is president. And then whenever they take control of the government, they jam up the deficit and the debt. And yet deficit and debt is an issue that not only objectively matters, but also is, you know, over 80% of Americans think deficit and debt's dangerous. They don't want Congress to pass laws that add to the deficit and the debt. Obviously, that's the first thing to be deferred. But particularly for your Republican friends who talk about the importance of this issue and then vote the other way every damn time. I mean, do they say anything different in private, or is this just, you know, we're going to have to fall off the cliff to realize there's nothing there?
I first want to say, I'm glad you mentioned that qualifier for Dick Cheney. I actually once just coincidentally sat next to him on a commercial flight for a couple hours and got to ask him about that. And I'll only say he was a lot more level-headed about it than he's famous for in that quote. He recognized that, you know, if it's one thing in one moment to run a deficit, if you keep doing it, it's a problem. I think there's certainly centrist politicians who recognize it's a problem, but there are an awful lot who don't. So on the let's say the Republican or the more conservative side, they say, oh, just cut taxes. You get so much growth, you don't have to worry. And needless to say, there's a grain of truth to that. They overstate it.
This episode of How to Fix It is brought to you by Wild Grain. Now, Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, artisanal pastries, and fresh pastas. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can actually pronounce, you know, and a slow fermentation process that could be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less with no thawing required. This is good stuff for the kids. I know. I've tried it for them and they loved it. Whenever I order their sourdough loves, I can taste the quality from the 20-hour slow fermentation process, and it pairs perfectly with slow-churned French butter, which they sell. I don't typically have, but it's cool when it comes. Plus, it bakes in 25 minutes or less. Imagine having fresh bakery quality breads, pot pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. You don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row. So for a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life. What? That's crazy. Go do that. When you go to wildgrain.com/fixit, all caps, start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/fixit or use the promo code FIXIT, all caps, at checkout. People forget, but it's very much within living memory, that Bill Clinton bequeathed a surplus to George W. Bush, who then used it to cut taxes and then didn't raise taxes during a war.
A very important moment, by the way, in our going the wrong way, when George W. decided we would both debt finance the war and debt finance a whole bunch of tax cuts at the same time. That started us on this political path, and it worked out for a little while because we got lucky, as America often does. But we're not going to be lucky forever about this. And you're right, Clint, we were actually back 30 years ago, people were worrying, what if there isn't any more U.S. debt? What if we paid it all back? There were people worried about how markets would work. I'm not kidding.
People were worried about that.
There were papers at the top conferences about how to operate financial markets when you don't have a safe asset, when you don't have debt. But and the Democrats believe that you can, you know, make everything free. I'm being hyperbolic, by taxing the 1%. And, you know, there's not a problem. And they point to the low interest rates, forgetting that they're not low anymore.
Well, and not only that, but let's isolate the Democrats you're talking about. In particular, I assume you're talking about the modern monetary theory folks who were saying not that long ago that deficits and debt don't matter. 100%.
Yeah, they weren't far off what Paul Krugman and Larry Summers were saying, by the way. I mean, because interest rates were low. And there were a whole bunch of very influential economists who had, you know, good arguments, though I think they were short-sighted, this time is different kind of mistakes, mm-hmm. where they were saying interest rates would just, they're not the same. The world's changed. They'll never be high. Now that we have the internet, interest rates will never be high again. I mean, that kind of thing. And, you know, that kind of thinking. And they were very influential with a lot of people. And so that's still a popular view. I think even the Trump administration believes interest rates are coming back down, I think because they want them to, but, you know, it doesn't mean they can make them come back down without having inflation.
Well, I mean, isn't that basically the quid pro quo of kicking Jerome Powell out? I mean, there may be indeed, with the most recent jobs numbers, there may be reason to do it. And Kevin Warsh has been the nominee, and I don't know what you think of his policies and proposals to date, but that obviously is part of the larger danger, that Trump seemed to make that a prerequisite for the next nominee.
Well, he certainly did, although I must say, I saw the Warsh appointment as a step back from the usual. There were a couple other candidates. I actually thought Kevin Hassett is quite a good economist, but he's very loyal to Trump, obviously. Warsh is conservative, but I mean, I think his loyalty is less obvious. Has he ever said that Trump won the 2020 election, for example, which is a litmus test for other candidates? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I'd be surprised if he did, though. But we should.
I don't think he did.
I
the same, and I'm not sure who else has gotten by that way. And I think Trump recognized he can't go too far on this. Warsh presented him with a thesis that thanks to productivity, there'll be deflation, and therefore I can cut interest rates without inflation. And let me just say that that's usually not the case when you have productivity rise, interest rates go up. In fact, when Paul Krugman and Larry Summers were arguing interest rates would stay low, they would say, why? Because productivity is very low, and therefore interest rates aren't getting bid up. So we'll see how Kevin does. I was pleased with the appointment overall and think that he has to try lowering interest rates. At least he has to try getting interest rates lowered. But I think, you know, if after a while it doesn't work, he will pull back.
Who do you look to? I mean, we will have another presidential election in 2028. And who are the sane centrist Democratic voices you look to who could be a credible Treasury Secretary under the next president?
Boy, I think there, you know, there's a plenty of people. Frankly, Scott Bessent's pretty good. I've been pleasantly...
Tell me more about that. I did not expect to hear that from you.
Yeah, well, okay. He has to say tariffs are a good idea.
Does he have to?
Well, he'd be gone.
Doesn't that compromise the credibility of the Treasury Secretary if he refuses to deal with math or abandons fundamental principles?
Well, okay. I mean, so that's a general question which people ask. I have, without naming them, a couple economist friends who are in the administration who I think very highly of, very highly. And you could say, why are they there? You know, how can they be in that administration? Why don't they leave? And I think the public service is important and I don't criticize them for that. And Bessent has really been the most, the adult in the room on a lot of debates, such as it is. But there's certain hot button issues, which you just have to say. He won the 2020 election. I don't actually know if Bessent said that, by the way. He might be another person who didn't. I don't know. But you have to say tariffs are a good idea. You have to say that Greenland should be a territory of the United States. You have to go along with these things. But I think at the same time, the fact that we had Warsh instead of somebody more Trumpy as the Fed chair, I would give Bessent credit for.
Okay. I'm gonna keep pressing this point, though. Let's go all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, right? I mean, you know, credit is based on trust. It's based on credibility, right? It's a perception issue as well as a balance sheet issue. And if you have a Treasury Secretary who refuses to deal with facts, look at an interview with Andrew Ross Sorkin, a deal book, you can pull up five examples, but really has become often an attack dog on behalf of Trump because he's playing to that audience of one. Are what you're saying is that everybody knows Trump appointees have to lie and therefore it's discounted and doesn't impact their credibility or the credibility of the United States? Or does that kind of Baghdad Bob act end up eroding the full faith and credit of the United States?
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
If Trump were to replace Bessent today with somebody else, you'd have a huge drop in the stock market because he has a lot of credibility. And the point is, he's been credible on a lot of things. So on tariffs, they're wrong. I mean, of course, tariffs are a tax. So any Republican, once they acknowledge that tariffs are a tax, I don't see how they could possibly think they were good. And they cause a lot of distortions. But I think it was probably right that they're not, just if you didn't move them all the time, but you just put them at 15%. It's not what we did. But if you did, not such a big deal, like not worth getting so worked up over. I think that actually a lot of economists would have agreed with that point that he made. I thought what they did with Argentina was amazing, of not having a default in Argentina. Okay. I mean, I'm not trying to defend every policy of the Trump administration. I don't want to be painted into that corner. But most people I talk to, and I would include academics, not just, you know, finance or politics, but my colleagues, think he's sort of the sanest one. Now that you can, you know, decide how you want to interpret that. But I think he's been, I'm glad he's there compared to the alternatives, frankly.
What do you think will happen with the tariff dollars the Supreme Court said were, illegal? I mean, you know, if it was being used to pay down the deficit of the debt, presumably you'd feel a little bit better. But currently it seems to be just sort of in limbo and possibly in someone's pocket.
I mean, it's small beer. It's like $120, $160 billion. We just talked about $1 trillion. It's just nothing. It's a hassle. The tariffs have been terrible for small businesses. That's who they hurt. I have a good friend here in Boston area who has a small wine business importing from Italy. She does not have generational wealth. She depends on this business. It's been a disaster because not only is there the tariff, but there are all the administrative fees that FedEx and others charge her. And I think it's been very, very bad for small businesses. Maybe Trump's done other things that are good for small business. I'm not praising them, but they haven't been, it's not really so shocking that they haven't been crippling. If you listen, I just came from the International Trade Seminar at Harvard before we spoke, and we were having papers on this before Trump, you know, how big a deal would it be? And the short answer is not as big as you think. But it doesn't make it good, but not as big a deal as you think.
With deficit and debt going past 100% of GDP, we've got, I think, tracked for $1.8 trillion deficit this fiscal year. Fair to say you think we are on an unsustainable path?
I think we're going to run into trouble. I think we're going to keep spending till we're blue in the face and keep running up debt. And the American people cannot be persuaded to accept something else until we have some kind of fiscal crisis. Now, there are, you know, I'm sorry to be a two-handed economist, but there are people who say AI will save us. Mm-hmm. Scott Bethen says that, by the way. Mm-hmm. We're going to get so much productivity growth, it'll save us. And there are a lot of problems around that. There's, first of all, jobs, safety. Will we actually collect any taxes when the tech, you know, billionaires?
So those three things you just mentioned are big things. Jobs, safety, and whether we will actually collect any.
No, I know. But I'm just saying that, but the comeback has been that we have AI and there'll be growth. I have a lot of concerns about what's going on with AI. And I think in some sense, that's even a bigger issue than the debt. But the short answer is yes. I think in the next 4 to 5 years, we will have a debt crisis that will at the very least sharply raise inflation, at least what we saw in the pandemic, probably for longer than we saw in the pandemic, and create other problems and undermine the dominance of the dollar, the topic that we started with. Why? Does it have to happen? No. Are there things that the good future secretary, who I haven't given you a name for yet, could take care of? That would be great. Yes, of course there are. But if you
what are those things? Let's just make it real clear. You're advising the next president. You're advising the next Treasury Secretary. What are those things so that we don't have to, you know, all of a sudden all get hit in the face by an economic 2x4?
Well, I mean, the basics are that the deficit at the very least needs to shrink to 2 or 3% instead of 6 or 7%. I'm not sure that that's good enough, but let's at least try to, you know, get the deficit smaller and see if that stabilizes things for a while.
And how would you advise the next president to do that?
Oh, look, I mean, it's painful. That's why it's a hard choice. You have to raise taxes. I think someday we probably need to have a value-added tax like they do in Europe. It's a much more efficient tax than an income tax. I don't think you can get it all out of billionaires. And people say, well, it's regressive, but we could, you know, use some of the money to have some, they call it universal basic income, but it can be a pretty low basic income, but give money back to low income people. That's, I think, something we probably will end up doing after making a lot of mistakes before then. You know, otherwise, you know, there are a lot of I can talk about efficiency as an economist. Clearly, old people like myself are getting a really good deal vis-a-vis young people. We have Social Security. We hold a lot of the wealth in the country. We all, it's a huge percentage of older Americans, you know, own homes and have wealth. And the young people are hurting a lot. There's lots of generational tensions there. There are lots of issues to be resolved. But a thing I can say is if we have a debt crisis, it's not good for anybody. Like, it's just bad for everybody. So I would try to find a way that's a political compromise to try to avoid that.
Well, I suppose that's what leadership looks like. And to your point, you could say absolutely.
And Clinton did that. I mean, everybody's disowning Clinton now. And boy, if he hadn't done that, our interest rates would have really shot up. I mean, he had a gun at his head when he was doing that. And I think he, Rubin, and Summers did a good job of that.
No question about it. How could you argue otherwise?
What are you talking about? I mean, the progressives view Clinton as starting austerity and benefiting the rich and being a disaster. I mean, at least I tell you, I teach at Harvard. I'm around a lot of them.
I've noticed that. But as has been pointed out, I mean, I think the caricatures of the New Democrats don't hold for Clinton or Obama's policies, frankly.
No, same.
So, but we'll have that debate.
I'm a big fan of both Obama and Clinton's, but that makes me a conservative here.
Okay, well, we're not going to judge you objectively by Harvard standards. As we wind up here, you know, we just had terrible job numbers, and indeed, there's a real question about whether our numbers are credible anymore. You know, that's one of the things that holds China back. What did you make of those jobs numbers, and what do you make of the credibility of our economic data, given the political sort of meddling that Trump has imposed?
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
So the job numbers, part of why they're bad is because we don't have any immigration. People have been discouraged from entering the labor force. So the unemployment numbers are not so bad. But the jobs numbers are very bad. But I'm very worried about the quality of them. I hear the Bureau of Labor Statistics insisting they're as good as ever. There are lots of reasons they're not. It predated Trump. There are technical issues around how the data is collected. COVID had all kinds of effects. But yes, the gutting of some of these key agencies, the technical staff, DOGE fired a lot of people, and some of those people did things we need. And having better numbers is something all economists agree on. And that's money very well spent if we did. And certainly cutting that and trying to politicize those numbers, that's what they do in China and not yeah. what we want to be doing here.
What about the cost of corruption undermining confidence in the U.S. economy? U.S. governance.
So when I wrote my book, I finished it before the election, and was, as you said, I mean, I turned out it was. I thought both sides had weaknesses that were different, but led to similar problems, and so I kind of correctly guessed where we'd be. But I tried to be politically neutral in a certain way of saying they're bad. This is bad that they say, this is bad that they say. And it served me well. But a year in, I have a paperback version coming out where I had to say something about this. Corruption is the thing I couldn't get away from. I think it's a cancer on our political culture, on our economic culture. I don't think it's going to go away. You can argue Nixon was a problem. I don't want to put him in. Okay, I don't want
to. Nixon was a Boy Scout compared to this crew.
Now, I don't want to. Well, I don't want to insult Nixon, but we had Gerry Ford after and Carter, and they were both sort of milquetoast, but they were clean, mostly anyway. And they really, however mediocre you think they were as presidents, they righted the system. We got away from that. I don't know that that's going to happen this time. I worry this is going to last for a very long time. What's the bar now on corruption? I just don't even know. There are areas I study.
This more, administration. It's not this president.
Yeah, the areas I look at more because it touches on dollar and stuff are cryptocurrencies. And I just find it mind-numbing that I disagree with some of the legislation coming out. That's okay. We can have different opinions. But I don't have a lot of faith in a government where they're making a lot of money off the legislation that they're passing. If the Trump family and other people in the Trump administration hold a lot of cryptocurrencies and they're making a lot of money by deregulating it, this is like, you know, civics 101 that you don't allow this. And I think it's going to hurt us a lot in the long run. I don't know that it happens right away, but, tariffs are even a problem. One of the troubles with tariffs is you think of who's my buddy, who do I give an exception, what countries get off, but the corruption is a huge problem. We can go into undermining the rule of law and all that, but the corruption I don't think we can debate with. I think it's a big problem. I think it's going to hurt the United States for a very long time to come.
It's a cancer on the American economy. It undermines our credibility and our reputation for being a safe harbor in the rule of law.
Absolutely.
Final question for you, Ken. You are a chess grandmaster, in addition to being a world-leading economist. How does being a chess grandmaster affect the way you think about the position the U.S. is in and how we can get out of it?
At a very crude level, I think it's important to think a few moves ahead, not just, you know, look at current events. My book this time is different from 15 years ago, was all about how people just look at the recent past and they don't extrapolate into the future, that it's important to look longer. And I'd say another thing is I do think we need to stay calm. You know, there's a tendency to get hysterical about everything happening. I think when you're a chess player, you're always making mistakes because nobody's perfect and you have to stay calm. And I'm looking at the situation in the world right now, and I don't know that we're going to bring calm, but this is a moment where that's what we need.
With that, Ken Rogoff, thank you very much for joining us on How to Fix It. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, John.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.